philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Weapon selection is critical. If I see one more idiot attacking a Jedi with a blaster pistol, then I'll kill them myself.
All these questions? Is a little blind faith too much to ask?
If you want a picture of the future, imagine a clown's shoe stamping on a human face forever.
I've never felt like a she or her, so I would prefer they or them.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space. I'm Thomas and that's Aaron. How are you doing, Aaron?
Doing great, man. We're starting off the year great. Everything's kicking in.
Hold on,
just right.
Let me just
right
drink
time.
A tiny cup of something here, real quick.
Oh man, no, you got.
I have to do the rest of the show as an ape.
You got to do the ape drugs like at least
later.
A half an hour before the show, or they won't come up at the right time. You're like,
yeah.
You won't get there until after dark, and then you're just like a tired ape that wants to go to sleep.
We watched. This is not a NASA, right? This is a regular episode. We watched Altered States,
it is, yes.
Which was a movie, mm-hmm. And very interesting. Simultaneously, lots happened, but also not much happened. Like, I could probably describe the movie in 5 words, or like a sentence
or two.
This is a
culturally significant movie that could have just as easily been on the NASA side of things if we wanted to play it differently. It is a important movie, but also a ridiculous movie and a beloved movie for me personally, both in terms of my childhood and overall philosophy.
Yeah, lots to say about it. I mean, for one, I had no idea what was coming for this at all.
I was excited about that, not telling you what was coming, yeah.
Yeah, and so I was like, oh, this is, some college intrigue, some experimental. I was like, oh, yeah, it's what's his name in the LSD stuff kind of, mm-hmm, and then it turns into Teen Wolf.
There is a little bit of Teen Wolf in there, you're right, with much better effects, I would like to say.
Yeah, the effects were actually, some effects are not as good, but some effects were really good.
Right. Adjusted for the decade in which it's taking place, there is, I think, quite a bit of innovative work being done and also some hilarious things that really don't work effectively that maybe we can discuss some of the details of some of that symbolism.
But I'm trying to look at who directed it, and I don't really recognize much else from Ken Russell. But there's an interesting style to it where... if I was going to make a joke about it, I'd say, well, they wanted to, trim the movie down. So they just had the characters all say their lines at once. We've got 3 hours of script here. So we could do it an hour and a half if you all talk at each other over each other, like the same, rather than waiting your turn, which I think, does inject some amount of realism into it, but also kind of goes a little too far in that people are just talking over each other constantly. Like nobody ever waits and listens ever. Which I think is not entirely how conversation works, but partially.
Well, I think it might be how conversation works with heavily drug-addled narcissists, which I think is part of the point of this movie, is that the world of psychedelics and altered states is one that is rife with these fevered egos that are sort of on the brink of their messianic revelations.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think that is,
it's kind
of a part
of
the film
though.
That feels accurate.
Yeah, it's not just
yeah.
It's not just William Hurt. Like every character, like just talks over each other the whole time.
Yes, well, they are all sort of highly intelligent individuals, and as you might have noticed in your travels, highly intelligent individuals do like to talk over each other and try to get finer edge points in as much as possible.
Okay, well, congrats! Points for realism for the movie. It was very interesting.
Points for realism for the glowy alien.
Yeah, until he turns into a glowy alien orb monkey something. Maybe it's trying to counterbalance it, like make some intense realism on one end, and then it goes, into the cosmos on the other end.
Yeah, I like it because if nothing else, there's a lot to talk about within this rather strange bit of art. So I guess maybe we should do the thing.
Oh, maybe we should tell a certain someone to bop it.
Bop it!
You're traveling through another dimension beyond that which is known to podcasters. It is the middle ground between fair use and copyright infringement, between ordinary fanboying and meaningful analysis. It is the exposition zone.
Yeah, so William Hurt is a man. What an interesting actor that guy is. Didn't we just watch him? Is he in Dark City, or am I remembering that wrong?
Yes.
Yeah.
We've actually. I wanted to mention he shows up in a variety of places for us. He also had that really beautiful turn in Humans as the inventor of the AIs.
Huh.
So that was and like it's funny to me because he hasn't like had like a hugely illustrious career,
yeah.
But there was this period in the late 90s where he was in like a bunch of different, like he was in Michael, that movie about the angel with
I think I saw whatever that is.
Oh, I don't know if you saw. That was one that I watched. It's like you could. It's probably a terrible movie if I tried to go back and rewatch it. But it's got John Travolta in it, and he's like an angel, and there's a bunch of ridiculous stuff that happens. But,
oh, I remember the previews.
Do you remember?
I thought that was. That's called Michael. Oh, okay.
It's called Michael. Yep, and I actually think it's a pretty sweet movie. I think it probably holds up better than, for example, his role in Lost in Space, which was in 1998. Which
oh, my God, I remember that.
I saw.
That was him, too. That's funny. He was in a bunch of stuff, and I just didn't put my finger on it.
It's probably worth NASA-ing that Lost in Space at some point. But he was also, you wouldn't know this, but for me, he was in the television sci-fi version of Dune miniseries. He played Duke Leto, and Duke Leto has a much larger role in that version, so that he will also in many ways be one of the Dukes in my head.
Well, I'm seeing that this was his first movie.
Is that right?
I mean,
no.
That's what Rotten Tomatoes says. I mean, it could be off, but I mean, it's the beginning of the list, 1980, Altered States.
Yeah, you're right. Everything before that is TV series. He had a couple of small bits in TV series.
All the TV series stuff is later.
Yeah. There's Kojak he was in 1977, whereas Altered States is 1980.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't have it on there. Yeah, I'm looking over at IMDb.
Oh, yeah, IMDb is a better source of that. But anyway, wow. I can't decide. Like, he was kind of hunky back in the day a little bit, you know?
Okay, so this is I also wanted to talk about actually is like I can't take Hurt seriously as a sex, you know, it's just like what we were talking about with York as well. Actually, we're just like I don't know if it's just the hair or the hair and the like everything. I like him as an actor, but I can never see like, and in this movie they really go in for some of the sexy time, and it just doesn't. I mean, it reads because like. I can only believe him as this incredibly weird, awkward, having a transcendental experience while someone's trying to have sex with you kind of individual. I can't take him seriously.
You say transcendental experience, but really it's just shouting about like Jesus or something like
shouting about Jesus while staring into a space heater. This movie was transformed. Like this was an important movie for me evolutionarily on a variety of fronts is what I'm trying to hint
at. Yeah, I'm with you on William Hurt. He's like almost a bit of everything. Kind of like he's like a hunky guy. He's almost like a intellectual, like just talking about typecasting him, you know, like he's almost that. He's almost this. He's kind of in between everything. And I don't know if he's a good actor or not. Like I don't think he's bad, but like, I'm like, is he good? I don't, it's weird. He's a chameleon, but not in the like character actor sense. He's like almost a little bit of everything. But anyway, so here I can explain this movie. William Hurt is a detached, aloof, maybe reads as like, does he read as like Asperger's or something? Like what is he actually, are they trying to go for that? He seems totally emotionally.
A little more towards narcissism, I guess, or delusions of grandeur, I would say probably. I think he has sort of.
Delusions of grandeur, but he also, I don't know what it is, but he seems to, that they emphasize he has no, like, he doesn't connect a lot on a human level. He's always head up in the clouds.
There's a bit of spectrum-y there. Yeah, I think you're right.
And so that's interesting. But also he's apparently playing a good looking guy. So he just easily beds, the main female character. It's just like, quickly. They're like, hey, want to go have sex? Yes. Okay. And then they're together. It really rushes through the beginning of the movie, like his life, you know, like they start off, they're kind of at the university still. And then, wham! There's like within a few minutes, they have two kids who you never really see much, and they're married, and they're thinking about getting divorced. like all in that span, you know?
It's very quick. We need to talk very specifically about one of those kids, right?
You do.
Did you notice?
Yeah, I didn't. You told me, but no, I didn't even notice the kids.
I didn't notice. Lou was sitting next to me. She didn't watch all of this movie, but she was there long enough to immediately look up and go, "That's Drew." And I was like, "What?" And she's like, "That's Drew Barrymore." And she was dead on accurate. It's Drew right before, I guess, E.T. or something like that.
Yeah, when was E.T.?
And she shows up on screen for like 3.5 seconds. Like, she's barely visible.
Yeah.
My wife just has a finely tuned sense of young Drew Barrymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a very specific special power, but she nailed
it. Oh, E.T. was 1982. Yeah, okay. So
yeah, so 2 years.
Crazy. Yeah, no, yeah. Wouldn't have noticed had you not said anything, for sure.
Because they don't matter. They really, as characters, are not at all relevant to anything that's going to happen in this movie.
Yeah, he just is very interested in drug trips and sensory deprivation tanks, and then, like, he gets out through Frank DeMira. Days of Our Lives is Frank DeMira. that's my finely tuned sense, is anyone who was ever on Days of Our Lives, because my dad, for some reason, watched it in the 90s, like, every day it was on. That's crazy, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's my weird thing. Well, I'm looking at Drew Barrymore's movies now.
That is super
weird. Donnie Darko is 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. Was that actually good? We need to do that movie. Was that good? I just assumed it was like we were all young and in high school.
Oh, Donnie Darko?
Yeah.
I feel uncomfortable answering that question without enough prep time.
Topic for another show. We'll figure that out. Oh, it says Donnie Darko 15th anniversary 100%. Is that like a... Okay. Anyway, so tabling that discussion. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, original Donnie Darko 86%. Wow, so they
put the pin right back in that grenade for now.
Bumped it up a 14% in the anniversary edition. That's cool. Anyway, he gets through Frank DeMira. Days of Our Lives is Frank DeMira. He gets some connection to like a, I don't know, some sort of people in South America that have been doing this drug, you know, for every year in a in a little ritual or something, and so he's been trying. He has this theory that like, because, you know, we got DNA, right? Here, see if you go with me on this. We got this DNA, right? And we have a lot of it, apparently. Lots of DNA. I'm not sure why that matters, but we got trillions of DNA somethings.
Stacked with DNA.
Yeah, we're just full of it, full of DNA. And then because we evolved or something, we have, like, stuff in our brains or our DNA. It's either in our brain or our consciousness or our DNA or all three. I don't know.
They're all the same. They're all connected. Okay. At one point he says in the movie, it's like, you know, it's a mind-body conversation, right? And he's like, memory is energy. It's all energy, 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 jingly keys. Hmm.
Yeah, and because of that, if we take drugs or do sensory deprivation-y thingies, we'll get some sort of connection to, like, that. We'll be able to, you know, starts off like that. We'll be able to access, like, the first man kind of thing. But what's weird is there's also a religious component in that he seems to either have been schizophrenic or you can clear that up. But like he's like, my theory is schizophrenia doesn't even exist. It's actually just this kind of thing. And like he has these visions of Jesus a lot, and that's connected in some way. So I guess we're to believe that's part of the primitive man thing. Like, I guess he's connected. If you're connected to the first man, and if you assume this whole Jesus thing is real, then I suppose you're also connected to Jesus or something.
Never clearly explained.
No, not really.
I could give you potential theories, but yeah, I think it is not. It's not made clear why there is the specifically Christian allegories being mixed in with this metaphor about the origin of time and memory and all these sorts of things. One potential possibility, right? One theory one could put forward would be that it's drawing on the heavy Catholic influence that goes into a lot of these South American traditions and sort of mixes with their sort of traditional native cultures in various kinds of ways. So I think that might be where the author was getting at some of this stuff. Maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, we get that schizophrenia is a disease thing, which I wanted to point out. Actually, I just wanted to tie that to our discussion back in Blind Sight, where we did sort of clarify the idea about like the difference between schizophrenia and multiple personality disorder. Here, they do seem to be talking about schizophrenia, specifically not just multiple personality disorder, but it seems to... It takes a similar kind of perspective that you see sometimes, which is that what is treated as a mental illness in one culture is viewed as a, you know, kind of form of euphoric insight in another culture.
Yeah. Well, I remember in college I read The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. Do you know that movie, book?
It's no.
About, I think it's about Hmong culture. It's been a while, but like, but anyway, the point is that was their translation or their word for, what is it called when you have seizures and,
Epilepsy.
Epilepsy. Yeah. That was their word for epilepsy, like working with the translators. That's why the book was called that. It's like, it literally translated to The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down. And it's kind of interesting. Yeah, it was a really good book, actually. But it reminds me of that. Like, I think that was kind of their cultural theory of epilepsy, was it was some sort of spiritual experience of some kind. But anyway, yeah, that kind of thing. And so he...
Let me just add. I mean, I just think it's valuable to just add in there that one concern that I'll talk about when we get into the philosophy side of this is that it's reasonable to be anxious about sort of cross-cultural translation in these kinds of ways that like makes it a little easy to kind of give the impression that we're all climbing the same mountain towards the same spiritual unified oneness or something like that.
Right.
And that like in the process, we're shedding all of these separate culturally conditioned views about mental health or things like that. I think that can be a very dangerous guru-y kind of place to slide into.
Sure, yeah. So let's slide into that guru-y place.
So let's do
by
it.
By going to whatever this tribe is that has this ritual, and they do the thing, and he takes the drug, and then he has some sort of trippy experience. 1980-era trip, somewhat. I don't even know how they're doing
a lot of firecrackers going on.
Yeah, a lot of firecrackers. Well, that one was, you know, that one was interesting. Because it was like, okay, I kind of I like that method of showing some sort of, you know, altered state, as it were. You know, like the idea that it's kind of a low tech way. Like there's just firecrackers going off and he's just like, you know, just like looking there. And it's like, you know, I've gotten blasted enough to where that resonated a little bit. not directly, but like, OK, I was like, all right, I could go for that depiction.
And when it got to the kimono dragon.
Yeah, no, and once you get to the Jesus-y stuff, I'm like, well, I'm out of it. That has no connection to anything. You know?
Well, I'm headed out.
If I ever did go on some insane trip, you know, like I was just like totally tripping my ass off and I saw Jesus, I'd be like, oh, that's fake. Fake trip. It's just me. Because I know it's not, that's not, you know, like religious people must think that means they're reaching some deeper truth, you know, like, oh, that means I'm seeing the origin of the whatever. And I'm like, no, that's obviously that means it's coming from my brain and I'm creating it, you know, like Jesus, like a white version of Jesus too. Oh yeah. A white version of Jesus is definitely the deeper truth of the universe that I'm accessing. Or maybe it's just something dumb from my brain. Like that would be my conclusion. Anyway.
Or maybe it's like in Contact where the universe takes a form that your mind can accept
and for
in
me,
order to
that's,
reach out to you.
That's white Jesus.
And for you, that's white Jesus. Hey, look, you've got some deep-seated issues that you need to confront. I'm not saying we don't have to do it on air or anything. I just, you know, if that's the way the universe manifests to you, then like,
who would it
that's,
be
that's
for
the
me?
Process you need to work through.
Man, who would it be for me? It'd be like Link from Breath of the Wild or something. Yeah, be like, yeah, okay. Breath of the Wild is the closest thing I've had to a transcendent experience. I agree. Maybe that would work, you know? Or maybe one of the dragons from that thing. You know, those things are so cool. Ugh. Anyway, he has that trippy experience. And then he decides, like, okay, what we have to do, apparently that wasn't enough. What we have to do is do that, but also in a sensory deprivation chamber. You know, they're all dusted over. Apparently they went out of favor. So they got to like, you know, they're like, oh, where is, well, there's one here, you know, we'll, you know, dig it out from the basement. And eventually, you know, not much happens in this movie because this is a whole movie. Eventually he does that finally. And we get Teen Wolf. And then he turns into a monkey man and he kills some people. He eats some animals that happened to be right next to a zoo, which I thought was convenient. But that's fine. Makes sense. I don't know. The university zoo or something?
I mean, it's very much American Werewolf in London is what it reminds me of, actually. I don't know if you're familiar with that movie, but in terms of, like, especially in terms of the special effects, the way they do the sort of the bladders under the skin where he's, like, bubbling at various points.
That looked really good, though. I was actually
amazed. Yeah, that's what I'm saying, that practical effect
stuff.
How
are they doing that? Was it practical
effect? Yeah, bladders. Yeah, that's like an air bladder that they inflate under prosthetics.
It looked really
good. Yeah, it's a really creepy transformative process. They
but
do
it's
some
like
good
usually
stuff.
The makeup is crappy when they do that, and you're like, okay, well that's obviously not his arm. But in this one, it was like that looked like his arm. I just thought it was his arm. It was good. It was awesome.
Mm-hmm. Or the spot with his stomach when he's in bed at one point. That's very Exorcist kind of feel. So, I mean, the monkey part is certainly silly, I guess I would say, and I feel like they try to make it scary, but it doesn't totally read, the makeup doesn't totally read, I think, but it's the stuff that comes after that that I think is more interesting and sort of open to interpretation, and I'm curious where you feel like all of that sort of culminates to.
Yeah, I mean, the next, he wants to do it, he comes out of the chamber at some point and he's like slightly turned into a gorilla. Like he can't talk and he's got blood on his mouth for some reason. And of course you got the skeptical, you know, the skeptical science guy, like from Ghostbusters 1, the dean that kicks him out. You got kind of that guy. And he's like, this is a bunch of crap, blah, blah, blah. And then they get an x-ray done and they look at the x-ray and the doctor's like, he's a gorilla. You're like, okay. So then you're to believe he's actually turning into a gorilla in this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose I skipped around a little bit. Yeah, sorry, that happened first. And then we get the full-on actual turn into a gorilla and eat somebody or kill somebody. And then he's like, I got to do it again. We need to do this again because nobody, you know, we got to figure out what's really going on here, et cetera, et cetera. So the final time he does it, he's got the wife there. He's got the, you know, the dean from Ghostbusters 1, and he's got the other guy who's been a sidekick the whole time, who's kind of, you know, not fully believes him, but enough, you know. And so he does it. And then instead of just turning into a monkey again, I don't know what happened. You'll have to tell me what happens here.
I was curious what your interpretation of the sequence is.
My interpretation is it jumps way off the rails. Like beyond the fact where it's like, okay, first I could believe that something's happening in your brain that's bringing you to this altered state. Which, you know, whatever. Okay, I'll go with you on that one. But now it's like affecting everyone or everything around him. Like it's almost like a mini atom bomb goes off in the chamber and then the girl is affected by it too. And I'm like, wow, your drug state is somehow infecting other people and like knocking them out. So that's a cool thing. So it goes way, way off the rails there. But I guess he's like, in my interpretation, I guess he's made some connection to God, to the origin of the universe, to whatever it might be. You know, it's not so much Monkey Man as something else, some energy. He just becomes pure energy, maybe. But the part at the very end is very silly because that all happens and then they just carry on, I guess. They're just like, okay, well.
So that happened.
Yeah, well, we better mop up. Like, okay.
It's kind of like an orgy where they all kind of clean themselves off and just like go about their lives.
Yeah, and then they go home, and then so he's home with the wife, and then it like happens again, I guess. You got some aftershocks, you know, some residual tripping, and he turns into a being of pure energy. And then... Then it's like, okay, you can fight it, you know, if you embrace your family, embrace your love for your wife, and, you know, you could fight back, come back to the planet of humans or whatever, this plane of existence. But then she reaches out and she touches him, and then she goes all energy. So, again, very contagious drug trip. She goes all energy, and he, like, the way he fights it is he beats the wall a bunch of times, which makes sense.
Yep.
You would think it would be something the opposite of what a gorilla would do. Like, if you wanted to get back into the human realm, you know, maybe, I don't know. But anyway,
there are limits to how we can represent this, you know?
Sure, I get it. It's a tough thing to do, whatever the hell this is. And so he bangs the wall a bunch of times back and forth. And he bangs the wall back to himself. Like, he's like, I hit the wall enough times. It's like hitting the TV or something to make it work. He bangs the wall enough times. He's back to just plain old William Hurt.
Well, to be clear, his color changes from a bunch of weird psychedelic colors every time he hits the wall. Cool. Like, he's strobing through channels or something.
Yeah. And so, it's so good. He does that. Everyone should watch it. He's back to normal. But his wife is still radioactive or something. Oh, so he's got to go. And then I was like, how's this going to work out? Well, the way it works out is he goes and hugs her, and then they turn into, you know, like good looking naked people, which, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
Yeah.
And the end. Bam. Okay. Mm-hmm. End of movie.
Yeah. You did pretty good there. Actually, I'm rather impressed. I was particularly impressed that you know, where you got the whole becomes one with the cosmos at the beginning of the universe kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's a great movie. I mean, it's ridiculous, it's absurd, but like what you describe as jumping the rails, I would describe as not like an active reductio ad absurdum, but a kind of, you know, reductio of the view that, like, well, the mind-body problem can be dissolved in such a way in which, like, the distinction breaks down and the mind can influence the body in all these kinds of ways, and it can influence it by, like, physically regressing the individual all the way back to the beginning of the universe kind of stuff.
Part is where it also, like, affects mm-hmm. everything around him. Like, it becomes something that's not just going on in his mind or his body. It's like the entire room changed and like all this stuff. That's what I mean, where it's like, okay, you've kind of gone further than I thought you were going to go, but okay.
Yeah. Well, but what I like about that is that it is taking this idea to its actual logical conclusions. It looks absurd. Yeah. And it's, you know, it is why I think there are sort of flaws with this way of seeing the universe. But like, I think it's a cool depiction of if you really take this mind over matter stuff seriously to a certain enough degree, then yeah, his trip expanding out and influencing other things around him in that way is part of the way this works. And that to me is also, that moment is a very Lovecraftian kind of moment. Mm. There's often these bits of, you know, there's often the climax of the Lovecraft kind of stories is, you know, and then the thing works enough that it rips a hole in the cosmos and everybody looking at it in that moment is like driven to some degree of insanity. Right. And to me, this is that sort of, this reads, I mean, very much to me as like a Cthulhu one-off kind of story in a lot of ways. And there is even actually stories that he wrote, like I think Beyond the Walls of Sleep is one where like they're doing experiments on people who are in dream states and they manage to connect with entities in other worlds as a result of those activities. So I think this is a great movie in that it's drawing on a lot of actual sort of stuff that was happening around these kinds of issues. You mentioned the sense deprivation tank sort of throwaway line about how they're all sort of mothballed because of the Timothy Leary stuff. And that's actually historically accurate, that there was a bunch of work being done on psychedelics that was sort of effectively shut down as a result of pushback against folks like Timothy Leary. Just for folks who are curious, I tried to do a little bit of digging to get a sense of which of those kinds of characters were sort of the influences of this particular movie, because I think some folks find that interesting. One would be John Lilly, who I believe is the inventor of the sense deprivation tank and was a kind of psychonaut of various sorts. Another would be Charles Tart, who did a bunch of psych and parapsychology stuff, and may potentially, I can nail this down, but I think maybe one of the influences for folks like Venkman and Ghostbusters, but like just this clusters of individuals who are, you know, trying to functionalize and operationalize these weird parapsychology fields. So yeah, I guess that's pretty much all we need for the exposition there, I think, right? So should we hit the philosophy then a little bit?
Yeah.
Why don't you just tell me the right answer?
Well, that's what's so great about the trolley problem, is that there is no right answer.
This is why everyone hates moral philosophy professors.
Yeah, let's talk about the ethics of turning into a gorilla and killing people. That's a tough question.
It's a hard one. Yeah. No, I mean, I think there is a lot of really important philosophizing to do around both the theory side of the use of psychedelics in epistemology, and also the practice side of the use of psychedelics in our world by human beings for things ranging from recreation to mental health treatment. I think all of those are important sort of questions that we can work through here a little bit. And it's very tricky to talk about this stuff because, you know, I feel genuinely torn as an academic and philosopher of mind, and also somebody who wants to have a stable career path, sort of discussing my own first person experiences with psychedelics in conjunction with these conversations about their role in things like, you know, gaining insights or understanding into the world that may not be directly accessible in other kinds of ways. It's a big problem that, you know, there is still a lot of stigma attached to these kinds of substances in various ways. It's complicated. I think in the episode, I think you and I both listened to Ezra Klein talking to Pollen about his recent book about psychedelics, which is why I thought it'd be a good topic for us to chat on as well. You know, they talk about the ways in which it's incredibly inconsistent how some individuals are sort of treated as criminal for engaging in the use of these kinds of substances, whereas other people are viewed as sort of visionary and revolutionary for engaging with them. And I, you know, I think that is a substantially sort of unjust, unfair universe into which we try to even have these conversations.
Oh yeah, I mean, the way that all turned out is, it just sucks. Like, it could have gone a different way, you know. I think the Nixon and Reagan, like a lot of those right-wing politicians had a big effect on this and the war on drugs and all that. But like, we could have lived in a world, in a country anyway, in which, you know, LSD was properly researched and, like, turns out, you know, some of these drugs might have a medicinal purpose that helps with depression and, you know, and psilocybin and all that stuff, which we're finally maybe getting back around to. But yeah, we could have been using this as an effective treatment for a long time if it weren't for the freak out over, like, the hippie drug trip culture stuff. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, and I have a lot of anger for the drug war stuff, but I've had to come to accept, even though I was raised from a very hippie background, that, like, there's guilt, there's blame to go around in terms of the way that these things were treated, and especially the degree of abusive cultish behavior that seems to sort of persistently sort of surround. And that's another thing that I really liked about this movie, is that it didn't, in my feelings, shy away from that kind of stuff. You see him with, like, his grad student at one point, and there's just this kind of casual.
Yeah. He just sleeps, you know, with approach. His grad student, and it's like barely, it doesn't even figure into the movie. It's like, no, it's the only point of this quick scene is, like, you're kind of worried that he's gonna turn into a gorilla and eat her or something, but, like, it's just they've slept together, they've made nothing of the movie has made nothing of it. It's just like, oh yeah, me and my grad student, you know, soon later. And then, you know, he's kind of like maybe turning into a monkey because of the aftershock effect. And she's like, professor, whatever, are you okay? Like, that's the whole purpose of that. It serves no other purpose.
And to reinforce the idea that he is this
he's a sex
sort
god.
Of personality type. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about, like, the epistemology side first, and then we can talk about, like, the mental health side of things, and then we can talk about the cults. On the epistemology side, right, there is this kind of question of, can you gain some sort of knowledge or understanding from the use of psychedelics, either in a way that, like, you can't at all get from any other kind of experience, or it's much, much harder to get from other kinds of experience. I think this is one way to frame this is commonly framed as a question, right? So it's compared, psychedelics are often compared to things like meditative states that you can get into that involve a quieting of the parts of the brain that have to do with sense of self and the location of the sense of self. And the softening of that can sort of give a heightened sense. One way that it's described in certain situations is a kind of heightened sense of connectedness. And, you know, so this is where it gets, I think, tricky. I would say personally, right, at this point, I have not seen any evidence that, like, Let me back up a little bit more, right? There's different ways to talk about kinds of knowledge, I would say. One is just like gaining factual knowledge, right? Like learning that 2 + 2 really does equal 4 or something. And then there's a different kind of gaining of understanding that comes with internalizing certain claims or ideas that you can understand on a sort of simplistic level, but not on a kind of experiential level, I guess would be the way that I would put it. Things, you know, the kind of philosophical stuff that we talk about, like, what does it really mean for you to believe that you don't have free will, and how do you really internalize that kind of belief and not having free will, separate from just mouthing the words, I don't have free will.
Yeah.
Right. So what I have experienced.
Oh, sorry.
What I have experienced personally, I won't say that, you know, nobody ever gets the like first kind of knowledge from doing psychedelics. The like, you know, I suddenly understand astrophysics in a different way or something. There are sort of there are stories of brilliant individuals sort of having breakthroughs in their research involving psychedelics. What I've personally experienced is more on the internalizing side of things, where the use of psychedelics allows for the breaking down of the systems and boundaries that we put up between ourselves and the other. And there's just like these walls of protection that sort of dampen the outer world. And when so for me, when I've done, and this is just talking only about doing mushrooms, I've never done LSD or anything like that, it really does. Like, it feels like everything goes up to 11. Like, it feels like all of the world is, like, pressing in on you more in a weird kind of way. And that combined with other sort of experiences that go along with it, I think really does help one to internalize and recognize that the distinction between self and other is in many ways highly constructed. And your experience of reality, broadly speaking, is like a very tenuously constructed system that could easily like slide in all sorts of very weird ways, which I think allows you to better recognize that, like, to better at least get away from sort of the naive perspective of reality as being just the kind of thing that we're walking around and experiencing in an uncomplicated fashion all the time. All right, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a ton of thoughts. Well, first off, I wanted to say that, like, this is interesting. And when you talk about, this is something that I think, at least when I've heard the traditional discussion, philosophical discussion about, like, knowledge or, you know, the black and white room. And then when you see something, do you learn something about color? And you can tell me, but I don't know about – I think this is more psychological, like, it might be one thing. For example, let me put it this way. I could know right now, like, oh, we're all connected and identity is a bit of an illusion or something like that. But actually having some experience that really makes you prioritize that. It's not necessarily like knowledge or not knowledge. You know, it's like, I could have or just something that might be a more everyday thing. We could feel like right now you could have this intellectual knowledge like, okay, I'm lucky to be alive. I'm lucky to, you know, have my family at a time like this. Or let's say I go through some harrowing experience, you know, like I don't know, I'm almost killed or I'm something just truly traumatic happens. Then I'm like, oh my God, I'm lucky to be alive. You know, like, it's not just the knowledge that you're lucky to be alive. You might have this entire paradigm shift in your brain where you're truly feeling that, like, oh my God, like, what is, you know, and that doesn't usually last forever, but you might feel like, wow, I am so lucky to be here. I might look at, you know, I might wake up and look at things in a different light. And it's not really like you've learned a new fact, you know? It's like, it's just your brain has certain things going on in your brain have maybe changed a bit to like prioritize that. And I wonder what you would call that. Like, would a philosopher call that some sort of knowledge? I don't know. You know, I think there's a lot of brain chemistry going on there that maybe doesn't, maybe, and you tell me, it doesn't fit neatly into like a philosophical, is this a confirmed, what is it, a something?
A justified true belief?
Or, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That was my first thought, and then I had some other stuff, but why don't you answer that first?
No, I mean, I think that's a really good way to put it. Like, it isn't, you know, knowledge, it feels like, in the sense of justify true belief. I mean, I guess you could maybe put it those ways, but like it feels more like understanding to me, right? Like understanding meaning sort of the difference between rote memorization and sort of getting why, you know, like not fully understanding why, but having a sort of deeper sense of this being the case. It's also, I think, as you correctly point out, it's partly about prioritizing and emphasis, that like you already have these ideas in your head and this is a thing that forces you to center them and to push a bunch of other stuff that is normally in the center of your concerns, like into the background. A lot of the time when I try to understand this stuff, I try to understand it in terms of, like, it makes sense to me to understand the gestalt therapy stuff a lot more that I've talked about before, and the like the self-other contact boundary. Like for me, psychedelics is all about making the contact boundary highly permeable and sort of taking off all your armor as a self for the sake of, you know, getting some greater connection to like, I really don't like describing it as sacred, and we can get into all the different things that I don't like about the way that all of this stuff is discussed, but one of the ones that I find consistently frustrating is that there's always an urge to turn it towards the sacred or the divine. And, you know, part of that is probably some of my own psychological stuff that I could probably be working on and dealing with. But I think also part of it is that I see that language as being too easy a stepping stone into a lot of problematic places, and that it's, you know, I guess I lean more in like a Taoist direction where I persistently want to resist reifying what this is. Because let me also just say, the way you were sort of just talking about it there, you can see how easy it is for this discussion of this understanding to slide into mental health and like using these drugs to reorient someone's perspective, where you don't like teach them a new fact, but you teach them a new way of seeing the world that allows them to be less depressed or something.
Well, honestly,
like
I would look at it as and I'm not I'm not a scientist, but it feels to me like, you know, if Socrates were here discussing this, it might be in a more simplistic form of like, okay, our brains are fact knowy thingies, like either, you know, and but really it might be a question of, you know, You can know a fact. Like, for example, just one of these sort of, I don't know if you want to call it a deepity, but one of these things we're talking about, like we're all connected, or, you know, like we're lucky to be here, or we don't have free, whatever it is. You could just think about that in one mental state and then imagine that, you know, the fun, happy brain chemicals, you know, that everybody else is able to produce but me. No, I'm just kidding. Like serotonin or whatever it might be. Then imagine you have a ton of that, and then you're thinking of that same thing, like we're all connected. Like the way you're going to act and the way you're going to actually, you know, mentally feel and even physically feel is going to be drastically different depending on something that I don't think has anything to do with knowledge. I really don't. Like it's not like you're learning any differently or there's some surrounding, you know, fact statements that you know any differently. It might just be your brain chemistry, you know, is oriented a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I am sympathetic to that. And, you know, I am sympathetic to using it as these sort of ways to give people empathetic experiences that allow for them to heighten and develop their capacities for empathy more, as well as their sort of addressing of PTSD.
Well, based on the episode I know we both listened to, and I've read some stuff by that guy. It's also treating addiction apparently works incredibly well. Apparently, I mean, I don't know. I guess maybe we'll find out if states legalize or at least decriminalize some of these chemicals. But apparently it just rewires the brain and you just don't, allegedly you can have one of these trips or something and it just completely takes away your desire to be, you know, on a certain substance like alcohol or I think smoking too. It's really interesting.
Yeah, there was some early evidence. I think one of the anecdotes was that there's some early evidence that led the guy who started Alcoholics Anonymous to seriously consider including LSD as part of their steps.
Yeah,
because of its effectiveness for dealing with alcohol. So yeah, it absolutely. Now, you know, I think there's a lot of value in doing that research, and I want there to be much more of that research. And at the same time, right, just like with the sacred stuff, I get really worried about the medicalizing.
Yeah. I get just worried about a bunch of gorilla men running around eating eating our zoo animals, you know, batoning our security guards to death. We got to be, you know, we got to be on the lookout for that stuff. Yeah, why we do the science
that,
first.
That's absolutely the case. That was my main concern. And then, like, you know, like, secondary, deeply secondary, like, almost tertiary concerns would be things like, you know, it creates a system where science becomes the permission structure for all of this. And it's only valued in, like, it pushes it back towards the, like, you have to be able to prove knowledge in some kind of way. Like, you have to quantify this. Like, it has to be replicable in these kinds of ways that I think, you know, I don't want it to just be in that sphere. I do want it to be research, but I don't want it to be compartmentalized entirely in that way, because I do think there are values that individuals can have that are valuable experiences that don't need to be in these highly controlled environments. I do think that set and setting is incredibly important. And, you know, I think hopefully there is greater knowledge amongst the youngs about set and setting and the ways in which you need to create a healthy environment for the kind of trip that you are looking to have. But I guess, like, really, I feel stuck in the middle between the folks who want to medicalize this kind of stuff, the folks who want to make it sacred, and the folks who are, like, really rabid about this is just for fun, right, and want to keep it as this, like, only hedonism kind of thing. Like, I think all of those elements, or some version of all of those elements, is worth taking away from it. But I really think we should resist, like, classifying it in just one of those kinds of ways. Some other stuff I want to mention. There was a story attached to that Pollen book about sort of a cancer patient who took I think LSD or one of them, and you know, had sort of fairly transformative psychological experiences, and sort of mentioned that they felt that everyone deserves to have this experience. And this is where things get very, very delicate for me as an educator in terms of how to talk about this. But I do think there is something to the idea that a psychedelic experience could potentially be valuable for almost anyone at some point in their life. There are important caveats there around mental illness and the risk of triggering some forms of mental illness that I think are really, really important to flag. But, like, you know, in the like world of experiences of things that I think, you know, most folks should try at least once in their lives, I think it's reasonable to include psychedelics among them.
Yeah, that's why I regret that I haven't, and I wish that we knew more about this, or had been, you know, that that scientists had been kind of free to study this whole time, you know, for however many years. You know, because I don't know. I was interested to know. I certainly didn't know. Like, I didn't realize LSD was just invented in a lab. Like, it had no, like, natural, you know, it didn't come from, like, a flower or something.
And invented is generous. It was accident.
Yeah. And I had no idea about that history. I think it's fascinating, but it's not very old. You know, what was it, the late 50s or something like that? And, you know, there's Timothy Leary, there's all that stuff. And then eventually they weren't allowed, nobody was allowed to do, in this country anyway, to do the kind of experimentation you might want to do. And we, you know, you referenced that there, you know, there's guilt to go around on all sides there. It's not as though it was like, you know, just a persecuted minority situation. But still, I would love it if this whole time we had some good science on this and we knew, like, hey, yeah, this is something everyone should do in their life. Here's exactly, you know, set and setting, as you say, or whatever it is. And here's exactly what you should do. And here's what you can expect. And here are the percentages of times that anything has gone wrong and what the risk factors for that are, you know. And that would be super cool if I felt confident enough to just go do that somewhere. As of now, I kind of don't. I would love to, actually, but I don't really feel like we're there yet. But that's just me.
Yeah, and I mean, this brings me to the part where I get really frustrated, because while I do think this stuff is valuable, when I look at the kinds of resources that are available to people who might want to try this stuff, it makes me really uncomfortable, because a lot of it does feel very culty. So, you know, for example, we were going to talk about Carlos Castaneda. We're almost out of time at this point.
We're out of time, actually. I know.
Well, I'll talk about him more after dark. Yeah, I think
we could watch Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and then do a part two.
I know. I think he's also heavily influential here and a hugely problematic figure. And yeah. I want to talk about
Hunter S. Thompson or?
Oh, no. Carlos Castaneda. Hunter S. Thompson for different reasons, I suppose.
Yeah.
But like, you know, just broadly to sort of put a cap on our conversation, I get very anxious about people going and trying to find communities that are pro psychedelics, because I do think there continues to be sort of a lot of abuse out there, and I just it's really frustrating that in the current situation that we're in, I think we're still a good ways off away from like it being safe to secure this kind of stuff consistently.
Yeah. Well, we are out of time. As we said, we'll have to decide what we're going to do. Well, you have a few seconds here because you got to give us a preview for next week. So anyway, Aaron, what are we talking about next week?
Yeah, no, we'll come back to this stuff more. Okay. I'll talk about Castaneda some after dark. And for next week, we're going to – there was an HBO show that came around recently that folks wanted us to cover, and I couldn't bring myself to cover it because of my deep-seated aversion to Ridley Scott. But we're going to talk about Raised by Wolves, and we're going to talk about you know, the philosophy around raising children with either religious or non-religious beliefs and the ethics of whether you should.
Well, I love that.
Yeah, I thought you might. I thought it might be slightly
I'm planning on raising my kids, having wolves raise my kids. So I think that'll...
There you go. See?
That'll work out, yeah. I mean, it just saves
APA.
Time.
You're not going to just release them into the air bison herd?
If there were an APA, I suspect I wouldn't have a choice. Like, my kids would be like, no, we're going with APA. Left you. Sorry. Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm excited for that. I haven't watched that show, but so what should me and the listeners, what, like episode one or what? How much do you think?
Yeah, we're basically going to talk sort of just the bare format. We're not going to go, I'm not going to be spoiling anything too interesting, I don't think, because I honestly don't think there is much to spoil in the show.
Yeah,
right. There will be lots of burns. Don't worry.
Okay. All right. Well, let's also see what our fine patrons over at patreon.com/zeroG want to make you say this week.
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you. But as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
Yeah, thanks to our strong AI patrons. Terrified will be pecked to death by lame ducks. Andrew Seidel's butt is into buttress stuff. Winchester's forever. Thomas's APA plush fund. Dude. Corey Ebert. Aaron's French accent is my favorite accent. I want to be the tempeh in a Foucault and Camus sandwich. Jesse Urbanowitz and Brendan Goodman. The coronavirus apocalypse is making me too depressed to think of anything clever this week. Anathem episodes make my pussy throb. Chad T. And a new strong AI patron, Gabby. Thank you all very much. And all
new
thanks
strong
to...
AI. Cool. Congrats.
Yeah, we got a new one. And thanks to our... definitely pretty sure not a clone or something we invented during a hallucinogenic drug trip. Sam Buck and No Commute, so behind on podcasts.
All right, good stuff. Well, thanks so much, patrons. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. And we'll see you after dark. Come hop on.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.